Murder suicide is the kind of tragedy that leaves all of us asking why. That's what we're figuring out by talking to the people who've lived through it. Unlike the often sensational coverage of true crime in the media, the aim of our podcast is to give our viewers and our listeners an up close and personal, accurate account of murder suicide, the risk factors, the personal experience, and the aftermath. On our podcast, the real expert is a person who's lived through it, the survivor. Welcome to The Final Act. I'm Dr. Joni Johnston, a forensic psychologist and private investigator. I also bring a personal perspective to this topic, as does my co-host, Jacqueline Jameson, a mental health professional for the past 25 years. Jackie lost her daughter to murder-suicide 10 years ago and has spent her professional time since then helping survivors navigate the complex journey through grief.
Yeah. Hi, Joni. So this has been a passion project, I guess you would call it, for me, but also, lived experience with my own story, which I'll share about. But I wanted to just take a minute to say thank you, Joni, for the work that you're doing here and for all of the time you're putting into this podcast. I reached out to Joni, or I found out about Joni, actually. I found out about you through the Murder Suicide Loss Network group that I attend now. It took me, my tragedy was about 10 years ago, and it took me almost those full 10 years to find a support group online that dealt directly with and or about murder, suicide, loss. And so it's a peer-led support group. And I attended probably three or four different support groups that are usually once every few weeks in the evenings before I was invited to join one of the committees to work on sort of outreach. The group recently became a nonprofit in January of this year, just a few months ago. And so one of the committees, we talked about the work that you're doing and the initial project that you were doing. I'll let you speak on that because I don't have all the ins and outs. But I wanted to reach out to you because I was immediately interested and curious about some of the data that you were collecting and some of the curriculums that you were working on and the fact that you were personally invested and that you had your own reasons for wanting to do this. So that's kind of how this all started. And I think you asked me, actually, what do you feel like the biggest, you know, splash would be in order for us to be able to get the word out, to be able to talk to people, get the information that we need, maybe talk about triggers, awareness, education. And my response was, let's do a podcast. Let's go on the internet, because this is a worldwide reach and it can get us so much further than maybe just writing a blog or putting out a newsletter or just putting something on the website. So that was my main goal. And I'm so happy that we started this project. And I'm very happy to share my story today and talk to you a little bit about your why too.
Well, it's been quite a journey. I really got hooked up with the Murder Suicide Law Support Network through my own research. I mean, I literally kept coming across murder-suicide cases, and I'm going to call them cases because that's what they were to me at the time. I did a lot of writing, and every week I would get these news feeds that talked about children who were lost and a husband who murders his wife and then kills himself. And I started thinking, you know, I never had any training in that area. And so I started looking, you know, what is being done in this area? Who's doing work in this area? And I had trouble finding anybody, but I did find an organization out of Georgia that was doing some work, and they introduced me to Mitch and Jenna and some of the people that we'll be interviewing this season on The Final Act. And a couple of things struck me, one being this sense of how I don't fit in anywhere. That really kind of touched my heart. I heard so many stories from people that I spoke to who said, you know, I don't fit in at the violent murder group. I don't fit in at the suicide loss group. I feel, because they're all in the same family. And I just feel like I don't fit in anywhere. And the other thing I think that really motivated me personally, as well as professionally, is there seemed to be some specific parts of murder-suicide that I think are easily missed by mental health professionals. And so initially I had an idea, and I still do, of doing some training for mental health professionals to recognize the kind of unique part of murder-suicide and how important it is to screen for that, particularly when you have somebody in your office who's expressing suicidal ideation and they have a conflictual relationship, or they're going through a custody battle. There's so many aspects of that that I think are very important. And so you and I did meet in that way. And it was completely your idea to do a podcast. I was very excited about doing it, especially given the fact, and this is one of our major, I think, purposes for talking about this today, is for you to share your story, because you have so many almost unspeakable parts of your story that I think are just so important for people to hear.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate, I guess, the opportunity to talk about it on such a large platform. And I say large platform because it's not something I've really done before ever. I've told my story at county victim services events or victim services month, awareness month banquets. I've done a plenary at the Parents of Murdered Children's conference during lunch and things like that. But I've never really taken the time to share my story like this one-on-one and maybe answer questions and kind of dig into some of the things, like my side of the story, for instance, you know, some of the things that I actually think about or go through on a day-to-day basis. And I think what makes it even more unique on some level is the fact that I am a mental health professional for over 25 years. I was licensed as a mental health professional in the state of Florida in 2003, and I've had private practices on and off. I've worked in multiple nonprofits. I've worked in child abuse. I've worked with the county. I've worked with Department of Children and Families, domestic violence, you name it, you know, I've done it. And the fact that I was in a relationship where there were very covert manipulations over a long period of time with somebody who was also a licensed clinician. And there's a lot of stigma around that. There's stigma for me and shame and some embarrassment around the fact that I should have been aware. I should have had some knowledge. I should have taken more steps, should have done this or I should have done that. And maybe people don't think that, but that's what I feel people might think. So I've been a little hesitant to dig in and unpack some of that.
So when you think about your story, I guess, where do you begin?
Where do I begin? Well, you know, there's so many different layers to my story. I was raised in South Florida, and I was, this is actually to me now a part of my story because I think there's a cycle here. There was sexual trauma and physical trauma as a child for me by my stepfather. And that was a secret that I kept for a long time, right? Because a lot of times when we are subjected to that as a child, we are told to keep that a secret or else. And so I was sort of programmed or groomed to not speak up about how I feel or about what was happening to me. And when I graduated from high school, I took a gap year, and then I decided I needed to get away. And I ended up going to college with the help of a wonderful mentor of mine to a school in Kentucky, and I'll take out names and places to, so that I don't, you know, offend anyone here. I'll try and do that. And while I was there, after my first year and a half or so, I came out as gay. And, so that was in, 1992 or 93-ish. And so you can imagine the stigma then around that. And I met my ex, who ended up being the perpetrator here, in college at a peer support group for incest survivors. So that's kind of how our relationship was built. It was built on the foundation of a trauma bond, really, or became later built on the foundation of a trauma bond, I guess I should say, because we met in a group for that. And she became really the first person in my outside world that I would share everything with. There was a time in high school where I did share with a teacher and my mentor. And so it did come out with my family and all of that, but I mean, to the world, right? And I actually, for the first time, was asking for help. So she was a part of that, my ex. And, you know, we fell in love and, we ended up graduating together and, coming back to Florida and started a life here. And looking back though, so for me, the red flags were the coercive control in terms of, I guess we should call it more of a, what do they call it now? Love bombing, right? Now we have a word for it, where there were cards every day. She would she would go into my dorm room while I was away at classes and, you know, buy me groceries and do my laundry and, you know, just do all of these things. And it really felt quite overwhelming. And there were things that she was telling me about what was happening with a person in her life that was abusing her still, that I still to this day don't know if it was true or not. I believe that it might have been a manipulation to try to get closer to me.
Was this somebody from her childhood who she was saying?
Yes, okay. It was a parent.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. So I felt kind of icky in the beginning, but it was one of those things where, gosh, she was doing for me at the time things that nobody else ever did for me. She paid attention to me in a way that I felt like nobody ever had before. I know my family loved me, but there was not an emotional attachment with my family. You know, nobody was touchy-feely. It was very kind of distant and separate. And I was, for the first time, I felt loved. I felt like I was being taken care of. I felt, so all of that, what we call now as love bombing, felt so good to me. And she was so charming and paid attention to me and just took care of me. And I needed that at the time. So anyway, we came back here and we started our life. And, you know, not to get into the nitty gritty of all of the in between, we were together for 20 years. And it was up and down over those years. There were some infidelities on both parts. And there were times when I felt like I wanted to leave the relationship, but I didn't. I didn't want to leave what I had. And we've talked about some of this, you know, you and I before. There's a stigma there already about, first of all, I was the only college graduate in my family ever. And I did this on my own because my family didn't support me for whatever reason. After all the stuff about the abuse came out, there was just such a separation. But I wanted to prove to myself and to everyone else that I could be successful, that I could have a solid relationship, even though I was gay. I was in the gay community. So I wanted the white picket fence, and I wanted the 2.5 kids, and I wanted the good job, and I wanted to be seen as, I wanted to be seen at like everyone else in the world who was a young adult being successful in their life. And so the things that were going on in the background, I never talked about with anyone. And while there was not physical violence, there was this undercurrent of lies and manipulations that I dealt with her consistently over the years. And I didn't know what to do with that other than to continue to just, you know, keep moving forward and trying to keep it together. And at some point, there was just like this acceptance that this was who she was. And there was addiction as well. So on her part, there was alcohol at one time, but mostly prescription medications. And so there was this sort of consistent struggle on and off over the years. I eventually, you know, I wanted to have children. I always wanted children. And so we went through the process after being together for 10 years of me going through infertility treatments. And I did get pregnant after 4 years through infertility treatments with my son. And we just kind of did the day by day thing. You know, we just lived life, and not all of it was bad, right? Not all of it was bad. There were some great moments. There were some wonderful memories, but definitely looking back, you know, lots of mental health, the things we hear now about narcissism and manipulation and love bombing and all of that definitely was there. Red flags were there. As time went on,
So just, she Jackie, began, can I interrupt you? Just yeah, ask sure, you a couple questions? Because sure, there's so sure, much information that you're telling me that, and there's, I have so many questions about that. I guess one comment first, I think, is just what a vulnerable time it must have been for you when you met her, because you're talking about a couple of things. You're in a group where you're sharing incredibly vulnerable stories. So there's that setting that to me is right, just is so interesting. And then you've come out recently, which I would right, imagine took a tremendous amount of courage and fear, I would imagine. So there's that piece of it to me in terms of you yeah, meeting her. And so I can't imagine why you would not respond to somebody loving you and caring for you and doing things for you that you never mm-hmm, had done for yourself. I mean, that was the first thing that really popped up for me is, wow, I mean, that's just, I can understand how anybody in that situation would respond similarly. And I guess the question I had though is when you're talking about kind of this manipulation or these lies that start. So I guess one question was, when did you first become aware that she was lying to you? And what was the manipulation like?
There's so many instances. I think I knew even in college when we first got together that I was questioning her truth. There's a one particular situation that I'm thinking about where I was actually dating a guy friend of mine. We went to a mixer, but I was also becoming very close with her. So it was really kind of before her and I decided we were going to, you know, try this whole thing, relationship together. And she called me to come. I was about a half an hour away. She called me and told me that her perpetrator had been there to visit her and had raped her. And she was in my dorm room. And I left the mixer but in that moment, I felt like something just didn't feel right to me. And when I got back to where she was, without going into too much detail, she was in distress. But it just seemed staged to me. And then I told her, right, you know, she needed to go to the school police and we needed to report it and what have you. And there was so much resistance there, but not the resistance that you would. It was more, it just didn't feel right to me. And so later I kind of found out more details that led me to believe that I just had too much information that led me to believe that that couldn't have occurred.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. And so there were things like that. And mind you, she was in therapy at the time with someone who was a professor at the school, but also a psychologist. And to go back to your question about the support group, absolutely. What brought me to that support group was I was a freshman in college and I was for the first time away from home experimenting with alcohol. And I was super depressed. I couldn't quite put my finger on why. I was starting to drink more. And I really was having these feelings of not wanting to be alive. I didn't have a plan to kill myself. I didn't want to necessarily do anything to harm myself, but I just was miserable. And so I told them, I went to the school counseling center. I told them what was going on. And they said, you know, you're not at risk for hurting yourself, but there's this group. And so that's kind of how that came about. And then she happened to be attending the group as well. So very vulnerable, absolutely. And yeah, I still have a lot of questions in my mind about where I was, where my head was at. And gosh, I was so desperate. I was so desperate to be loved and taken care of. And she was that person for me. And I didn't want to lose that. So I don't know if you want to follow up with that, because I kind of want to fast forward a little bit.
No, no, go ahead. Go ahead for sure.
Yeah. So I feel like I kind of need to I just wanted to kind of say how things started, how we met. But if we push the fast forward button 10 years ago in 2014 on Memorial Day, after I had left her just a few months prior to that, we separated. I was not there. I was not. She had a visitation with my kids. Actually, I left out my whole daughter scenario. I did have a daughter in 2010 via IVF, and Eliana is the main victim of this crime. So anyway, she had visitation with the kids, and I was at a beach function with a bunch of friends, and I got a call from a neighbor that my daughter was dead. And I didn't know what happened. None of us knew what happened. So they had to get me off this beach island and get me to the hospital, where I found out that she had drowned my daughter to death, tried to overdose my son, and tried to kill herself. So it's been 10 years now. Eliana was 2.5 at the time, and my son was 10 at the time. And he actually woke up from the incident and called the police. And that's how we all found out. I don't know if you have any questions about any of that. And normally I start off talking about the day. This is what happened, right? Because it's almost like when people have these incidents, it's BC, but what happened before and what happened after. So my life before and my life after. But today, I don't know why I decided to start with sort of the background a little bit. But both of my children were conceived through IVF. So it took a lot of energy and effort for me to have them. They are my world. And this loss was, you know, really tremendous for multiple reasons. Yeah.
And so you were told by a neighbor initially that your daughter had died, but you didn't have any mm-hmm. idea why or like what had happened or anything.
I did
and
not, it
was
no.
Only at the hospital, then you find out kind of the full scope of what's going on. And your son, who's 10, is the one who found or who woke up.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And where was your ex at this time?
So she had them at my apartment. I left them with her before I went to, because it was Memorial Day. So there was a function, and it was a planned visit because we had separated. Right. But she was there with them. So when the, police arrived, she was unconscious, on the floor. And, my son was in a robe, you know, kind of frantically running around with the phone, talking, trying to get neighbors, trying to get someone there. He actually woke up to find his sister, my daughter, in the bathtub. So the door was locked. He had to unlock the bathroom door and pull her out of the bathtub and then call the police. So he really was kind of a hero that day. And unfortunately, because of that, he still has many struggles. He's 21 now. And it's been a rough 10 years, if you can imagine, I'm sure.
So when your son woke up, is it safe to assume that your ex, is that the best way to, how should I refer to her? What is the best way to refer to her?
You can say ex.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. You're separated. Your ex, the perpetrator, mm-hmm. she assumed that he was also dead?
I think so. We're not sure. There was a suicide note on the computer that she wrote. And there were pills everywhere. So she had also tried to kill herself with prescription medications. So according to my son, he said that she was crushing up medicines and putting it in their coffee and trying to get them to drink it too. And what she said to him was, this will make you bigger and stronger, because that's what his doctor said to do. And he had big trust in his pediatrician that he was saying. And I guess Ellie would not drink the drink. And so she was telling him, chug, 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 drink the drink. It's going to make you stronger. So she was made sure that he drank everything that she asked him to drink. And then she said, I'm taking Ellie into the bathroom to take a bath. That's the last thing he remembers before he woke up. Sometime in between there, what they're saying is that's when she wrote the note. It was clear enough to understand what it said, which was basically, you did this to yourself. Now you can go be with all your little friends. Basically, you know, deal with it. Now you get to deal with this. Because you hurt me, so now I'm going to hurt you. That was kind of basically it. So it was a crime of passion, a crime of jealousy, a crime of, it was also later found to be premeditated. She had looked up things online about, you know, Xanax and different things that they found, medications. She visited a few doctors, got extra medications before she came. So anyway, when my son woke up, he knew to look in the bathroom because he couldn't wake her up, right? He couldn't wake my ex up. He remembered Ellie was going to be taken in the bath. He couldn't find her. So he tried the door. It was locked. He unlocked it and then he pulled her out and then he went and found his phone and called 911. Yeah.
He really was a hero.
Yeah. You know, and in so many ways, he feels like he should have been the one to know better, to know that she was, you know, he was 10. There's so many things that happened with him too, around coercive control and manipulation and lying, to lead him to believe that I was the bad guy in all of this, in the separation, in the divorce. And I had started dating a friend of ours. And so there was that as well. And he believed her, fully trusted her. They were very close.
So it sounds like it was basically revenge was the main motive.
Right.
Is that kind of the sense that you made of it? I mean, because it sounds like the note was an angry note. Essentially,
yeah,
it was fault. And,
yeah.
You know, this is why, you know, I'm not doing this. You're making me do this, essentially.
Right. Yeah. It was an angry note. It was a revenge crime. She finally woke up 2 days later, they were able to, question her on the way to the jail. And, she denies remembering anything. And then later her defense was going to be multiple personalities or dissociative identity disorder because of trauma. But when you live with somebody for 20 years and I lived with her for that long, the only thing I ever saw was addiction and blackout scenarios. Not, I don't know who I am as a person. Definitely not multiple personality. You know, a lot of us who suffer from trauma have some level of dissociation, I think, when we're triggered. And it's a coping strategy we use, and that's what we call daydreaming or checking out. But we know our actions, we know our behavior. Unless we are taking a substance that stops us from remembering. So I believe that that's maybe what happened, is that the she blacked out.
Had she ever threatened to hurt herself or the kids before? Mm-hmm.
Definitely a history of depression and suicide ideation. Prior to this happening, so this was in February of 2014. In December of 2013, there was a scenario where these are the kinds of things that began to happen. And I'll just give you a little scenario quickly. We were at a party with a bunch of friends of ours, all sitting around just chatting. And the woman she was sitting next to worked at an oncology center for kids and was also going through cancer treatment herself. And Kim said, "I know what that's like. I've had cancer and I've been through treatments too." She had not. And I wasn't the only person that overheard that. There was another person that overheard that as well. But I immediately turned to her and I said, you know, I kind of like nudged her and I said, what are you doing? You know, I'm like, we need to go. So we actually walked there because we lived in the neighborhood. And as we walked home, I just began to ask her a bunch of questions, you know, like, what are you thinking here? You already have a job, A. B, if you get a job based on a false premise, then what? You know, what's going on? And she couldn't really answer that. I was, of course, livid. And we had already been having some problems for multiple reasons. And later that night, she told me there was something else she needed to share with me. She had been seeing our longtime therapist multiple times a week for depression, anxiety, the fact that we were kind of working on separating. And I found out from the therapist later some of this information. But that night told me, well, I didn't want to use a name. My ex told me that she had been lying to her therapist, that she had been dating somebody named Nicholas who was very rich that was going to be paying for her sessions. And she was communicating with her therapist using an alternative email by Nicholas about the sessions and about how she was going to, about how he was going to pay. So the story began to unfold and unfold and unfold. Now, remember, this is December, January-ish prior to the May incident. So, and this was the next day after this incident with the cancer story. So as you can imagine, I was beside myself. I finally decided to reach out to some friends of mine. I called her mom. I called the therapist. And I just told everyone, you know, what was going on, because I was just blown away by what was happening. And I told her, I said, you need to go get help. You're going to talk to your mom. You're going to talk to the therapist. And she did. She went to a treatment center for 30 to 45 days for the pill addiction, for the depression, and to address some of these things that were going on, the lies and different things. So for all intents and purposes, when she got out, while she was away, by the way, I separated from her. I moved out. I took the kids. But when she got out, she was... from what we could tell, doing better.
And so when did she get out? Just to kind of give me a time frame. You talked about
March-ish. Right. And so she did come for a visit in March to see the kids around spring break. And that was a rocky visit. She begged me to take her back. She begged me to give her a chance. You know, I wasn't doing it. It was just 20 years of things getting worse and worse and worse and escalating. And the amount of lies were growing. And I just didn't, that wasn't something that I could do anymore. And I was really worried about the kids being around it. But she always really, especially with Ethan, had a really special bond with him. And I always said to her, you know, look, I'm not going to keep the kids from you. Our situation is our situation. Because no, there really was never any, to my knowledge, I didn't think she would ever hurt the kids. However, that being said, she did not want me to get pregnant with Ellie. There was a time in there where we moved from Florida to Virginia to be with her mom and around her family back in like 2009 to 2013 before we came back to Florida, where things got really rough. But despite all of that, I wanted to have another child. And so I, through IVF, was pregnant with my daughter. And she was not happy about that. And when Ellie was like 3 months old, one day she told me, you know, why I resent her, right? And I said, no. And she said, I resent her because I resent you for having her. And as crushed as I was by that, and I knew that they weren't really bonding, whoever thinks that the worst will happen? Yeah, she was distant from her. She wasn't as close with her as she was with Ethan, but there was never any maliciousness that I could tell. You know, never any hate or anything like that. Never any maltreatment. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that was, you know, she lost her job. She lost her family. She was struggling from depression and mental health issues. There were the pills. You know, what's that show called? Snapped? Did she snap? You know, I don't know.
So when she came back in March of 2014 from rehab treatment, and she seemed better to you, do you think she assumed that, I mean, she obviously wanted to get back together. Do you think she assumed that if she went to treatment, that somehow that would fix your relationship and that you, that was kind of almost like a trade-off for you having her back when she got out?
I think so, because I had so many years of compassion and empathy for her and giving in to her and her addiction and her, you know, physical and mental needs and all of that, that I just gave her chance after chance after chance. And yeah, actually I got a letter from her while she was in treatment, apologizing for her behavior, for her lies, for, you know, all of these things. And I thought, okay, for the first time, she's admitting some things. But I knew, and I even told her therapist, this is not happening. You know, I'm not going to be a part of her treatment. I'm setting up some boundaries. You know, you can see the children, but no, we're not getting back together. But yeah, I think maybe she did think that she could win me back. One thing I want to say about the question you had was, it wasn't until several years ago, really, that I found out through her mom that a few weeks before the tragedy took place, she had sort of a meltdown. And she was with her family and she was crying and all upset and said she was having thoughts of hurting herself and the children. Nobody ever told me. And like I said, I didn't know until after, way after court, you know, but she was charged and convicted over a almost 4 year long process. The state of Florida went after the death penalty. And during that time, we were all on what I call verbal lockdown. We weren't allowed to talk to the media. We weren't allowed to talk to the family. We weren't allowed to say anything to anyone about anything because it might jeopardize the case. And at that time we were going to trial, but, so it wasn't until after she was sentenced, there was a plea deal at the very last minute for life plus 30, no parole, to not have to go through trial. But it wasn't until years after that I found out what she said to her family.
I was going to say, what was your relationship like with her family and how much did they know about some of the things that she was saying, some of the things that she was doing. Obviously, they had some awareness in terms of the thing that she said about those thoughts of hurting her kids and herself. Yeah.
So I've had some contact with her mom. I was very close with her family. You know, her family really took the place of my family in a lot of ways. And I got things from them that I never got from my own family. You know, we lived with them for a while when we moved to Virginia. I met them when I was in college. They met me when I was a kid. This all happened when I was in my 40s. So, you know, they were my family. And that was a big loss. That was a big loss for everyone on both sides. And because we were forbidden from talking to them, there were things that I wish that I would have asked. I wish that I would have been able to talk to them. Now, that being said, they were losing a daughter or a niece or a sister, right, to this crime. And they believed that it was really due to her mental health issues and that she would have never done anything unless there were these mental health issues. So there's still some denial there around the sociopathy part of things that I clearly see and know because of the work that I do, but also because I'm not enmeshed, you know, in that way. But yeah, a big loss for both sides.
I can't even imagine, Jackie. I really can't. I mean, there's so many levels of loss.
There's a lot of layers, right?
So many layers. And not just, losing her family, as you were, mm-hmm. you were saying. And then there's the whole issue of 4 years of
right.
having to be silent and
court,
go
yeah.
through the court process. And I don't know how involved you had to be in terms of showing up for certain court dates and then your mm-hmm. son trying mm-hmm. to help him heal. And I mean, it's more than I think any one person can bear almost.
Yeah. sometimes my son really struggles. I had him evaluated once, when he was a teenager, well, not months, multiple times. He was an unfortunate, genetic, born with a pre-genetic disposition to my family of ADHD and anxiety, which I also struggle from. But the psychiatrist that I took him to after the trauma said, "I'm sorry to tell you, he's a perfect storm." I was like, "Oh, great. Is there a medication for that?" You know, he was a teenage young man who that speaks for itself, right? With all of the hormones and everything. But you have a human being with ADHD and anxiety, they're predisposed to it. And then on top of that, we have PTSD and trauma and a young man whose hormones are absolutely raging and out of control on top of losing probably one of the closest people to him by betrayal. You know, she tried to take his life. And so it's very hard now to watch him struggle and suffer on the days that are hard days for him. As a therapist, I can see it for what it is, but as a parent, I so badly want more for him. So it's this push-pull. And every time he has a hard day, it kind of throws us both back into it.
I was just going to say, when did he become aware, really aware of what had actually happened in terms of the fact that his parent had attempted to murder him and had murdered his sister?
That day.
He was aware of that at the time.
He was aware that day. Yeah. He was impacted by the Xanax that was given to him, but still able to tell the police in detail what happened and what was said. And we have all of that on video. I've gone back to it. He's so little. You know, we think sometimes when they're 10, 11 years old, they were so big. He was so little. And it breaks my heart. You know, I'm grateful that he did have the Xanax in his system because it was sort of, I would call it a brownout. He has the memories, but they're not of the day, but that doesn't stick with him, the little tidbits, as much as just the idea that this person that he knew as his parent, who adored him and who he adored, did this to him and his sister and to me.
So what has your journey been like in terms of healing and moving forward and helping your son?
Yeah. It's definitely been a journey. You know, when I first got that phone call, the friends that were there with me tell me that I dropped to my knees. I, you know, it was the guttural scream that you see on TV. I vomited. And they had to basically walk me, carry me to a kayak to be transported down the river to get to a police boat to be taken to the car. And I vaguely remember, you know, that scenario. We drove to the hospital, and then from there it gets fuzzy. But it's like you see on TV where they bring you in and they walk you to the back room and they sit you down. They tell you what happened. And then they interview you for hours about your relationship, your history, your kids, how you parent. Did I know? Just hours. And so then when that was done, I was able to see my son and then see my daughter, and say goodbye to her. And then they brought my son in and we sat next to my daughter together, and my mom was there and our pastor was there. And I would say, you know, that memory is seared into my mind forever, more than anything, probably just as much so as giving birth to her, you know, giving birth to her and saying goodbye to her are kind of right next to each other. What I didn't know was that, that my ex was, right next door. There were police all over the hospital. And, you know, later I found out that she was right next door. Anyway, so after that, later that day, I was actually taken to a hospital because I was in so much shock that I was nonverbal and just really out of it. And they kept me for a little while, and they gave me some sedatives, and I went to an undisclosed location because it was national and local news because of the Bible verse that she used. We had been to church the day before, and there was a verse about Abraham, you know, God told him to sacrifice his son. And she used that verse in her suicide note. So you could imagine the attention that that got from biblical scholars and people, the national news and all of that. It was on Nancy Grace. It was on all over the front page of our newspaper. It was everywhere. And so, like what I've heard from other people, like the media really is the way that they were finding out information. So those first few days, really, we were in an undisclosed location at a hotel. And I don't remember a whole lot, really, about the first weeks, months. About 4 months in, I was so depressed. I tried to go back to work, and I just couldn't manage. I couldn't handle. I'm a therapist, so I was trying to see people, and I was suicidal. I started drinking. I was taking Xanax that was prescribed to me by the doctors to get through a death of a child, and I wasn't able to take care of myself. I wasn't eating. I wasn't sleeping. I was a mess. So I happened to know enough about treatment because I worked in the treatment industry on and off that I reached out to some friends and they got me into a treatment center. So I was there for 45 days and it saved my life. After that, I came out and I just stayed in therapy. I took a year off of work and just really recovered and took time that I needed to heal. But it wasn't until I would say year two or three that things started to sort of feel okay again. I tell people sometimes I wasn't able to even plan for my next day. I wouldn't look at a calendar and plan ahead. I couldn't bring myself. I didn't believe that tomorrow would exist in the same way that today would exist. So it took me a long time just planning the next day and then planning the next month and then planning the next year. It wasn't until 2017 that I started cycling and I got involved in triathlons that really pushed me to set a goal for 6 months out, a year out, that I started to plan way in advance again. And that's actually one of the major coping strategies for me, was getting involved in triathlon at 45 years old. and I still do that at 52. And it definitely helps. The physical exercise, pushing myself. Some people say, you know, how do you do that? You know what? For me, there's no pain that compares to what I went through. Losing my child and losing my family and losing the light in my son's eyes and just my whole world crashing out on top of me. So that physical pain that I have to endure for however many hours kind of feels good. And I don't want to mean that in a weird sadistic way, but yeah, that's how I cope mostly today.
Yeah, I was in awe when you told me that you do triathlons. I can't even imagine doing that. But what a productive way to channel all that, you know, to channel all that, those emotions and let them out for a little bit. And what about, I obviously don't want to speak for your son, and if you don't want to talk at all about his journey, you mentioned he was struggling. Do you see him over time making progress? I mean, you know, with kids, sometimes, even in their early 20s, I look at my kids.
Yeah.
I have a kid. I have a 21-year-old myself, and sometimes I kind of go, I don't know. Is she going up or is she just coasting? Or, you know, where is she exactly?
Uh-huh.
So
That's
a hard question to ask of anybody, but I just wanted to know.
So I think the challenges of this generation in particular are way different from what a lot of other generations have experienced, right? You probably see that in your 21-year-old. They have a lot more to contend with, I think, than we did, for sure, in terms of the economy and the overwhelm with social media and the things that they're exposed to, which makes it, I think, more difficult for them to launch and to feel successful. I see improvements in him very slowly, I think in part because that frontal lobe part of his brain is maturing. Definitely there are some red flags for mental health. I would be lying if I said that I didn't have consistent worries that he sometimes, I am afraid that he will take his own life. He does suffer from ideation. He does suffer from some traumatic related personality characteristics in terms of distorted thinking. You know, a lot of people who, I don't want to label him as borderline personality, but those are the kinds of things that I see. And that is the push-pull, the wanting love and the wanting friendships, but at the same time, pushing people away out of fear that he's going to get hurt. And he also is not interested in therapy right now, and he doesn't want to take medication. But what 21-year-old man, I call him man boy, what 21-year-old man boy or man cub wants to do that? Not many. It takes a really, I think, mature 21-year-old, especially male, to want to go to therapy and do those things. I think it'll happen. I hope. And listen, he is, I forgot to tell you the part that he's a creative too. I mean, he was in, ballet and musical theater, and he writes music, and he's so, on top of all of that other stuff, like he's a creative. And so our emotions are kind of everywhere. And we feel things differently and we experience things differently. So I really, all I can do is hold on to faith and hope and unconditional love, which is sometimes hard. I want so much for him. And I hope and pray that he's okay. That's all I can really do.
You know, one of the things that struck me as you were talking, Jackie, is just how you've been forced to just deal with stuff over and over again. And I say that because, you know, my dad, after my parents divorced, his mom found him sitting in a rocking chair with a shotgun in his mouth, and he had taken the ring off, and he had had periods of depression. And so I share that only because growing up, I was so afraid of sadness in a way, or depression, yeah. Or like, I just wouldn't even acknowledge it in myself because it was so terrifying. It was like, if you are depressed in any way, you're just going to be stuck, or you're never going to get out of it. Or, you know, it's like a dog. It grabs a hold of you and it doesn't let go. And I think just the trauma that you've gone through, and then you have this child that has experienced that. And so even if you were trying to find ways to escape reminders of that, which I'm not saying it's possible, but I mean, you've never had any opportunity to do that. Right. Because you have to deal with this with your son. And right. So I just can't imagine how, you know, difficult mm-hmm. that has been.
Oh, so I am in recovery now. I do go to AA, and I practice those principles. I do have a strong faith and a higher power. I have a strong social support network. I practice self-care as much as I can. And I take medication now. You know, I see a psychiatrist, and I feel like, not so much now, but, you know, maybe a little bit, as a provider in mental health, helping other people, I hesitate to share the real me and the things I struggle with, because there are those naysayers that say only crazy people help other people. Only crazy people are therapists, you know? So I joke, I actually feel like it gives us a better understanding of helping people, but it's not something that I readily share, that after my daughter died, yeah, I had to take medication for depression, and I still do. And every time I try to go off of it, it doesn't end so well. Either I go back to drinking, or I go down a rabbit hole, or I can't get out of bed. And I've come to accept that what happened to me, not only in my childhood, but in my life and with this tragedy, it has changed me, fundamentally changed me and my physiology and my brain. And I'm unable to, my body and my brain is unable to generate the dopamine and the serotonin that it needs to function and to do these things that I'm doing right now. So that's a battle, you know. I had to, and I still have to. Every day I take my medication, I have to tell myself, if I was a diabetic, if I had cancer, if I had some other ailment, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, whatever it is, and I had to take a medication every day to keep those levels where they're supposed to be, I wouldn't question it. I wouldn't say, oh, I don't want to, you know, why do I have to take this? I would just take it because I would know that it was keeping my body in balance. So I have to just remind myself that this is no different. And although it's been, I think, stigmatized to feel different or to be looked at differently. So going back, I was saying, you know, sometimes when I share in meetings, I say, I only survive with the three S's. A psychologist, which starts with a P, a sponsor, which is in recovery, and serotonin. So, you know, I joke about it, but definitely I have to have all of those pieces of the pie to keep it together.
What are your biggest, I guess, wishes and goals for this podcast?
I think I just want people who are out there, not just the people who have stories to tell because they've been through it, but the general public, people that want to help people, people that are concerned about, you know, a lot of people will, when bad things happen, right? We're like, how can we help? I want to help. And so my hope is that through the stories that are told, we will provide some way or some venue to educate people, to make people aware, to help people understand maybe also about grief and recovery when it comes to such a significant loss. Because I still hear things like, it's been 10 years, you know, it's been 20 years, it's been 3 years. It's, you know, can we get over this already? Can we, you're still crying about that, you know? Now, I don't really have anyone in my life. I'm so blessed to have people in my life that are still hanging in there with me. I had a friend yesterday give me a little butterfly pen that said, let go, let God. And, you know, butterflies were a thing for me in remembering my daughter. So I'm blessed in that way. But I just want people to know that, that we still need you. You know, I need that support ongoing. I need for people to know that I need that compassion. I need for people to understand that coercive control is a thing, that the signs and the red flags and the triggers can be so subtle and so much over a long period of time that you question, am I making this up? You know, I think there's so many nuances to why people commit a murder suicide. I don't even know if we really talked about what is a murder suicide. I mean, so if somebody kills someone else and then they take their own life or they attempt to take their own life, I mean, that's the bottom line, right? That's the premise. It's so nuanced. And so I just hope that people hang in there with us to learn more about it and get engaged and, yeah, ask questions.
I think those are such worthy goals. And I guess just kind of in closing, I love that you were saying, you know, if people ask, how can I help? What would your answer be? You know, how can understanding is one thing that you said, and being compassionate. But I think people sometimes don't know when they have a friend or a family member or sister-in-law, whatever, go through something like this, because yes, it's not common for this to happen, but it's a lot more common than I think most people. I was telling my husband that there's 10 on the average, 10 a week. And he said, no. Yeah. I mean, he just didn't believe that. And it's like, no, there are. So
right.
It does happen. How can people help? What should they do?
I think there's multiple things. I think on a macro level, like on a big picture scale, to maybe just spread the word and let people know, hey, you know, this exists, this happens. And this is not just the random true crime show that you see that is dramatized or whatever, sensationalized, but this happens so often. If you just Google murder-suicide, it's like, you know, even in your local area, even in small towns, it happens so much more frequent. And I think we're so bombarded with other news, especially right now, with politics and all of these things, which really just escalates the percentage or the potential percentage of murder suicides because people are overwhelmed. So I think, let people know, have these conversations at dinner, when you're having pizza, when you're at a Super Bowl party, when you're hanging out with friends or you're online, you know, just, we know about gun violence. We know about school shootings. We talk about it. I think this topic is not talked about enough. And I think it needs to be talked about more. And then to be helpful on a more individual level, I think that really is an individual thing. If you have a family member or a friend or somebody that you're concerned about, just ask. hey, you know, is there anything I can do to help? What do you need? Do you want me to ask you questions? Do you not want to talk about it? Because it's different for different people. I often feel like sometimes people want to talk about it, but they don't want to upset me. So I'm often the one to bring it up, especially with friends that were in this scenario with me. I've since kind of reconnected with some of them, and I've actually been the one to say, hey, it's been 10 years. We haven't talked about it. Do you have any questions? Is there anything you want to say? How do you feel? And so to not be afraid, I guess, to bring up their name, to celebrate them, to be curious, to ask questions.
Well, I really look forward to going on this journey with you. And
yeah, I appreciate it. It was
kind of all
over the place with my story. It was tough. It was tough to kind of decide which direction I wanted to go in today. But I think the big stuff, the important things were talked about.
I think you shared an amazing amount of information. And I think I just can only imagine the people it's going to touch who listen and watch as we move forward. So thank you so much, Jackie, for sharing that.
Yeah. And thank you for your share too. And I'm sorry for your loss as well.
No, I appreciate that. But you know, everybody has a loss. I think that's one of the things that they do. I mean, it's, you know, I know there are scales and, you know, some losses certainly seem bigger than others, but I don't know anybody personally or professionally who hasn't undergone something in their life. So I think talking about grief in all kinds, different kinds of ways, I think is always a good thing because it's like family secrets. You know, it's like some of these things we need to shine the light on, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And stuff. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the last thing I would say. Speak up, speak out. Don't hold your secrets. If you are going through a hard time in a relationship or with another person or you're concerned, definitely share that with someone that you can trust. And I came to the Murder Suicide Loss Network, which we're going to talk about more in the upcoming podcast. And so murdersuicidelossnetwork.com. And we have peer support groups. And that's actually how Joni and I met. So definitely reach out if you need some support.
Thanks again, Jackie.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening or watching, and we look forward to introducing you to our first expert, starting with our podcast episode number 1 coming soon.